From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. This morning, the headline sprawled across the top of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette is in Hebrew from the start of the Kaddish, the Jewish prayer for the dead. The city is in mourning for the 11 victims of Saturday's deadly anti-Semitic attack on a Pittsburgh synagogue. Tree of Life congregant Dean Root spoke to CBS.
It just seems so painfully, brutally ironic that a hate crime takes those who share love.
President Trump, all in on hardline immigration policy just days before the midterm elections. In remarks from the White House, he says he will take executive action next week to end what he calls abuse of the U.S. asylum system.
Under this plan, the illegal aliens will no longer get a free pass into our country by lodging meritless claims in seeking asylum.
Join us. What signs of hope do you see after the killings at the Tree of Life Synagogue? The election's coming up next week. What's determining your vote? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us now, from NPR's own studios at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, you may recognize the address. That's our White House reporter, Aisha Rasko. Aisha Rasko, welcome back to On Point.
Hello.
Also with us from Washington's Mary Bruce. She's congressional correspondent for ABC News. Delighted to have you here. Mary Bruce, welcome back.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, David, Aisha, and Mary.
I want to start with the comments of Rabbi Jonathan Perlman. He leads a conservative congregation that worships at the Tree of Life Synagogue and spoke during a vigil Sunday night in Pittsburgh.
This will not break us. It will not ruin us. We will continue to thrive and sing and worship and learn together and continue our historic legacy in this city with the friendliest people that we know.
Mary Bruce, these killings broke a lot of hearts in Pittsburgh and across the country. How seriously and in what way has it registered in Washington?
Well, I think the president's reaction in some way, you know, is something we've heard before. One of the first things he said is that things would have been different if those inside the synagogue had been armed. That sparked a fierce reaction from many, including from the families of some of the victims. And then we saw the president very quickly, traveling to Pittsburgh there to pay his respects. And what is really remarkable is the fact that the president there had these interactions with these protesters on the ground there, how instantly what really was a solemn occasion, as we saw at the beginning of these funerals, then became so political so quickly, because you had so many members of this community voicing their frustration with this administration, their disgust in many times with this administration. And then it became this mudslinging, this tit for tat back and forth, where, you know, the president came out and said that, you know, he didn't really see the protesters, he felt that the media was kind of ratcheting up and being responsible for trying to blame the president for some of the violence that we've seen. So it was just remarkable, you know, how quickly we saw the aftermath of this become so political, and the focus in many ways, quite frustratingly, I think, for many across this country, became on politics and became on finger pointing as this community, of course, is still reeling from this incredibly horrific violence.
Aisha Rasko, one of the things that struck me was the extent to which elected officials of both parties declined to appear with the president and his wife as they traveled with Pittsburgh to note the deaths of these congregants at the synagogue. On Monday, CNN's Anderson Cooper asked Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto if he had any doubt that heated and divisive political rhetoric had an impact on the massacre that occurred at Tree of Life Synagogue last Saturday. Peduto told him, "Words matter."
When you put words of hatred out in a place where those words had been hidden and recognized as being words that were not acceptable, and you allow that to become acceptable, then you allow the next steps to occur. The next steps where there is violence against people walking down the street. The next steps where there's graffiti being written on walls. The next steps where somebody enters into a place that is so sacred, where people go to find sanctuary and peace with God, and somebody feels that is the way that they will express their hatred with murder.
Aisha Rasko, how much has this incident caused the White House and the president to rethink some of his more pointed rhetoric.
It doesn't seem that it has caused them to rethink it at all. They reject the notion that the president has any responsibility regarding these acts, whether it's this act at the synagogue or the pipe bombs that were mailed to kind of prominent Democrats and other public figures. Their argument, and Sarah Sanders has said that the president is not responsible for the divisions in this country, and they kind of throw it back on the media. But it was striking that when he went to Pittsburgh, to not have any to not have the governor, to not have the mayor, to not have people on either side of the aisle, none of the congressional leaders, even the Republicans, go with him, I think shows how kind of fraught the situation was. And the fact that he was asked not to come by local officials who just said it was too soon, but he went anyway. And there were these protests when the community is still reeling from what happened. So I think that the White House is moving ahead in pretty much the same way it always has. But there was pushback on this.
Aisha, you covered the White House. You know, the president did talk about the need for people to essentially reject violence. He talked about the need for people to embrace civility and decency toward one another. And yet, as you say, he pointed to the media as being fault. He really, in other appearances, you know, almost immediately on the campaign trail, was willing to point to figures and actors that he felt were responsible for bad things in society. How do you, in covering this, reconcile those two strains of what the president had to say in recent days?
For me, I think when I'm looking at this, it seems like the president, he has the words that you're supposed to say as president after an event happens. He will say, we need to come together, we need to unify, and there should be no violence. And he will stick with the there should be no violence. But when it comes to going beyond that, and when you get to rallies, maybe not insulting people personally, or, you know, maybe trying to extend an olive branch to people who he considers opponents to kind of cool down the rhetoric, he doesn't go that far. He will go to the line of saying, this is unacceptable, we should come together. But he doesn't go beyond that to really kind of change his behavior or to just kind of cool things down by reaching out to people on the other side. It's just not his nature. It's not what he does.
Check, Beatty, the president often likes to make everything about himself. But in this case, the president and his aides say, look, he didn't commit any violence here. And in fact, the accused shooter in Pittsburgh was somebody who said the president didn't go far enough on certain things, was too much under the influence of Jews, as we understand it from social media postings. Isn't it, to be fair to the president, isn't there some truth to that? I mean, how much would one assign responsibility for the president for actions that he had physically nothing to do with?
Well, you know, there are comforts in literal-mindedness, and I suppose that would be an example. But I think a Pittsburgh protester had it right when he said he had, quote, no doubt of the dotted line between the president's rhetoric and violence. A dotted line, not a single line. And after all, what was the president talking about? He was talking about this caravan in coming up through Mexico. He was saying it was funded by George Soros. That is an anti-Semitic trope, thriving in authoritarian places in Europe. And the president is still at it. So he was saying that. And this murderer. Was acting against that idea of the immigrants coming in the caravan, and there was a Jewish agency that would help to settle them and to, you know, help them out. In other words, he was directly in line with the president's rhetoric. There's this caravan. A Jew is funding it. The Jews are going to settle the people. Boom.
You know,
dotted line
right there. I want to take a call from Oded, calling from Grafton, Massachusetts. Oded, please go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to mention two things. One is that the attack by Mr. Bush in Kentucky was structurally similar to what happened at Tree of Life Synagogue. Mm-hmm. I went to kill blacks. It so happened the church was locked, so he went to the next best place. And the other thing is, from people who were there, who I'm in contact with, they protesters actually blocked Trump from getting to his at least one of the destinations he was going to. And it shows a universal, at least in Pittsburgh, rejection of Trump's attitudes and all other parts of his persona. And he was going there not to pay his respects, as your announcer said, but rather just to pad his reputation.
All right, Oded, thank you for contributing that. The incident you're referring to, of course, two African Americans were killed at outside a supermarket in Jeffersontown, Kentucky, a suburb of Louisville. A white man was charged with that, and there, I believe, is an investigation going on as to whether that's a hate crime. Mary Bruce, briefly, the president seems kind of unaffected about this on the campaign trail, but in the 30 seconds we have left, he referred to this as something of an interruption for himself, didn't he?
Yeah, the president did, effectively put his campaigning on hold in the aftermath of this to make that trip to Pittsburgh. And then he was right back on the trail again. And what's interesting is that while you've had the president in many ways, calling for a softer tone, urging politicians not to attack their opponents as being morally defective, he's sort of taken this pause to be, presidential, to condemn the violence. But in practically the same breath, the president then is back out there on the campaign trail, attacking candidates, attacking party leaders, being that same old Donald Trump that we're used to seeing on the campaign trail.
So, folks, Mary, Aisha, Jack, stick around. We want all of you to stick around. We're talking about the week in the news. You can join our conversation. What did you make of President Trump's claims about his ability to end birthright citizenship with a flash of the pen? Is this tough talk on immigration helping to spur a needed conversation or just a distraction for the home stretch of the election season? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're recapping the week's news in the final days before the midterm elections. You can join the conversation. What will drive you to the polls on Tuesday, or before if you're voting early? Is it all about the president, as he sometimes says, or is it about something else entirely? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with ABC News congressional correspondent Mary Bruce, NPR White House reporter Aisha Rasko, and On Point's own news analyst Jack Beatty. In an interview with Jonathan Swan for Axios on HBO, a new show from the digital news site Axios, President Trump made claims about birthright immigration that were just simply factually incorrect, just wrong. He also said he plans to end this constitutional right and to do so with an executive order.
Now they're saying I can do it just with an executive order. Now, how ridiculous. We're the only country in the world where a person comes in, has a baby, and the baby is essentially a citizen of the United States for 85 years with all of those benefits. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
So first, I have to note a few things. First, more than 30 countries have similar birthright citizenship policies. Second, many of these babies that are born here go on to work in the U.S., pay taxes, contribute to the economy. A study from the Cato Institute this year found that immigrants have far lower arrest and criminal conviction rates than native-born Americans, despite some of the president's claims about crime. And finally, the 14th Amendment says, in fairly clear-cut language, all persons born or naturalized in the U.S. and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and the state wherein they reside. Aisha Rasko, what the heck's going on here?
The president is taking up an argument that has been made, was made by one of his former National Security Council staffers, Michael Anton, and others, that the 14th Amendment includes this clause about, the jurisdiction thereof. And they're arguing that basically people who are in this country illegally are not under the jurisdiction of the U.S. in the context of what the 14th Amendment meant. So the 14th Amendment wasn't meant to extend to people in this country illegally. Now, there are a lot of scholars and legal experts who say that's not the case. And this has been the way the 14th Amendment has been carried out for decades, for years. But this is what the administration is, I guess, arguing at this point. But we don't have anything in writing. We don't have an actual policy. There isn't an executive order at this point. So basically, you have President Trump throwing this out there in an interview and kind of talking about it. But we don't have anything concrete, and the White House isn't saying when they're going to take action, what's going to happen with this next. And we know that this will be challenged legally if they do try to move ahead with it.
So do you give any credence to this actually being something the administration pursues?
I would not. I would never say that they will not pursue it, because I think that this is in line with the way this administration looks at immigration. They take a very hard line. And so I think that this is something that they may try to carry out. I think that a lot of things, like even when you look at the, you know, when they did the zero tolerance policy at the border, a lot of people probably wouldn't have thought they would have done that. But they did go ahead with it. And until there was an outcry, it continued, and they stopped it after the outcry. So I wouldn't put it past them. I don't know if this is just a trial balloon.
You know, Jack Beatty, by virtue of the president talking about this, we're all talking about this. And yet this isn't a, hey, on the one side, some people say this. Hey, on the other side, other people say that. A lot of people, even people of the president's own party, have fundamentally disagreed not simply with the thrust of the policy, but with his ability to do this. Here's what House Speaker Paul Ryan said Tuesday about President Trump's claims about his ability to change birthright citizenship. Ryan was talking with the Kentucky radio station WVLK.
You cannot end birthright citizenship with an executive order. We didn't like it when Obama tried changing immigration laws via executive action. And obviously, as conservatives, you know, we believe in the Constitution. You know, as a conservative, I'm a believer in following the plain text of the Constitution. And I think in this case, the 14th Amendment's pretty clear.
Jack Beatty, do you think the president can get traction with this, particularly among his supporters?
Well, the president slapped Paul Ryan after that in a tweet, saying he doesn't know anything about the 14th Amendment, as if the president did, and he should get back to worrying about the midterms.
Two of the nation's top constitutional officers of the same party going after each other.
Yes. And of course, Lindsey Graham coming in on the president's side on this. And by the way, when you look into it, this was raised by Democrats, Harry Reid in the 90s. So it's not as if this is just the Republicans who've talked about this. But there is a longstanding canard about, you know, the people coming over here just to give birth. And that has to be stopped. In fact, a study of immigrants, I think undocumented immigrants largely, found that 90% of them weren't births until they were here 2 years. In other words, they didn't come to give birth. They got couples had children after they were here, a year or more after. They came not to give birth, but to fill the jobs Americans don't want. But that has not stopped the right wing. It was Sarah Palin was big on this years ago, and it fits the president's modus operandi, really, of poisoning the well here and just doing everything he can to fan the flames of racist paranoia.
Perhaps worth noting at this point, as a number of legal scholars and lawyers have in recent days, the 14th Amendment, of course, stems from the abolition of slavery to ensure that the children of freed slaves were seen as full citizens, even though their parents had not been originally viewed that way by the Constitution in the states in which they lived. You know, the president didn't only talk about birthright citizenship in terms of immigration. He's been talking about a lot of things, and he's been promising to send troops to the border. At the White House yesterday, the president suggested migrants coming toward the U.S. border from Central America would be shot if they throw rocks at troops deployed there.
They're throwing rocks viciously and violently. You saw that 3 days ago, really hurting the military. We're not going to put up with that. They want to throw rocks at our military fights back. We're going to consider, and I told them, consider it a rifle. When they throw rocks like they did at the Mexico military and police, I say, consider it a rifle.
President Trump was referring there to a report by the Associated Press in recent days about a violent standoff at what was the Guatemala-Mexico border on Sunday, where migrants apparently threw rocks and used sticks against Mexican police. The AP reported one migrant died from a head wound during the clash, but the cause was unclear. Mary Bruce, a number of former military commanders have said that it's inappropriate to encourage soldiers deployed near the border to fire, that's a problem. How is the president's statements on this being interpreted there?
Not well. And look, the timing of all of this simply cannot be ignored. This is about the midterms. The president has made very clear that he thinks immigration is a winning political issue for Republicans. He has been quite transparent about that. He's tweeted as much. He's said as much publicly. And the president's closing argument here is fear, plain and simple. You have seen him ratcheting up his rhetoric and these false claims, outlining essentially a doomsday scenario in which he says America is going to be invaded and overrun by undocumented immigrants. He is demonizing this caravan of migrants who, by the way, are fleeing poverty and violence, and which is still some 900 miles away right now. But that's not stopping him from acting. So now you have him, you know, promising a new executive order to crack down on asylum seekers. You have him saying he wants to send up to 15,000 troops, which is roughly the same number that are in Afghanistan. And now saying he's going to potentially fire on migrants if they throw stones or rocks, which he says should be treated like rifles. This is what seems to be a pretty blatant political play by the president, and it's hard to know which of these things he's really going to follow through on. To Aisha's point earlier about ending birthright citizenship, and in the meantime, it's making, you know, some military leaders, former and current, putting them on edge about, you know, what the president's really doing here in terms of moving around our military might for what seems to be, making a bit of a political play ahead of the midterms to try and excite his base.
You know, Mary, others have been pointing out the question of whether this is all related to the elections. On Tuesday, Democratic Senate candidate Kyrsten Sinema, who is a congresswoman, spoke with the Phoenix TV show Good Morning Arizona. Host Javier Soto asked her about President Trump's move to end birthright citizenship. Here's what Sinema had to say.
He actually doesn't have the authority to do that because our Constitution protects this right for Americans. This is really just a distraction, trying to get voters to talk about something else. But the truth is that voters in Arizona know exactly what they're concerned about. And what I hear from folks everywhere I go, Javier, is health care. They're worried about their own ability to take care of their family and get health care benefits for themselves and their kids.
I'd like to take a call now from Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, go ahead.
I tell you, we're saying something that we've never seen in either of our lifetime. Democrats stand on message. Democrats, no pun intended, stand on point. And I am so proud to be a part of the Democratic Party that they're not falling for any of these distractions by Donald Trump. And that's all they've been talking about for the past year and a half to 2 years quietly. Healthcare. And all of a sudden, the Republican Party is realizing, oh my God, we took all those votes on healthcare. The Democrats have been staying on message about healthcare. And this lunatic that we have in the White House is talking about everything else but healthcare. And now you even see people that voted, literally voted 50 to 60 times to do away with pre-existing conditions, Republicans, making ads saying that they wouldn't do that, but they've already tried to do it. And I'm glad to see the Democratic Party finally figuring out if you stay on message and if you have a message that the American people want to hear, then you will be rewarded by victory in November.
All right, Carl, thank you. We've just heard from Carl, a proud Democrat from Nashville, Tennessee. Jack Beatty, it almost seems as though, as I saw Matt Visser of the Washington Post say online this morning, that the Republicans and Democrats are running different races. The Republicans are running a race on immigration, and the Democrats are running a race on health care. So it's not a debate over an issue. It's almost a discourse on two separate parallel lines.
That's true. With this caveat, Republican candidates are squirming and, frankly, lying about, as Carl said, that they, therefore, pre-existing conditions when they voted against it again and again. And the president has said he's for preserving them. He is, his Justice Department has joined a lawsuit that would end them. It's a campaign based on lies. The Democrats are campaigning on a real thing. Healthcare is threatened by the Republicans. Mitch McConnell says if they win the House, they're going to go after Obamacare again, the remnants of it, pull up more of it. They're going to go after Medicare. They're going to go after Medicaid. Healthcare is on the ballot, and the Democrats have an issue that among Democrats is mobilizing people, not among Republicans. There, as you say, it's immigration.
And I want to apologize to Matt Visor for misrendering his name, but Mary Bruce, you cover Congress. My recollection was that the Republicans have held both houses of Congress. It had a Republican in the White House for almost the past 2 years, and they didn't get to overturn Obamacare this time around. What makes you think they would be eager to go do that, given that their own polling shows that the, among other things, protection for pre-existing conditions ranks pretty high on the list of people, the things people want to retain?
Well, and this is part of the reason why Republicans are in a bit of a jam out there when it comes to healthcare. It's why you're seeing so many Republican candidates essentially try to have it both ways. They'll say, yes, they still want to repeal Obamacare, but now you see Republican candidates saying, oh, but they do want to still protect or keep in place those protections for people with pre-existing conditions. The problem is that Republicans haven't been able to come up with a plan to do that yet. And as you note, they have been in power. They have failed to coalesce around a replacement plan. And it leaves a lot of voters concerned. Republicans are well aware of the fact that healthcare is one of the top issues for Republicans or for voters. They're well aware of the fact that now more than 50% of voters say they have a favorable view of Obamacare. And so Republicans are going to have to come up with a replacement plan if they hope to appease voters. But the issue is how can they do that? And can they do that while still trying to repeal it? It's become a real issue. Take, for instance, what's happening in Missouri with Josh Hawley, the Republican Senate candidate there, who on one hand wants to repeal Obamacare, but has signed onto a lawsuit that would repeal Obamacare and its protections for people with pre-existing conditions. He says he, like so many other Republican candidates, wants to keep those protections separate and apart from Obamacare. But so many voters are concerned that if you repeal Obamacare without a replacement plan, that they're essentially going to have the rug pulled out from under them.
One of the things about this election is that obviously the stakes on the national level are significant for who holds each chamber of Congress. And we'll talk a little bit about the stakes in a couple minutes. But a lot of the excitement seemed to be in other races, like the gubernatorial races. You have one in Georgia, which in some ways highlights the excitement and in some ways highlights the very question of voting, pitting the Secretary of State, Republican Brian Kemp down there against Stacey Adams, a longtime Democratic assembly leader there, as well as a voting rights advocate. Yesterday, Oprah Winfrey popped up in Georgia to campaign for Stacey Adams, the Democratic gubernatorial candidate.
I'm not here because I'm making some grandstand because I'm thinking about running myself. I don't want to run, okay? I'm not trying to test any waters. Don't want to go in those waters. I'm here today because of Stacey Abrams.
And Oprah has it right. I had it wrong. Stacey Abrams. Aisha Rasko, two quick things. What's the status of that race in Georgia? And what's the status of Oprah Winfrey's interest in running for office herself?
Well, both sides are trying to get to get people to the polls early. Early voting is going on in Georgia, and there were signs that there has been an increase in turnout among African Americans. Of course, with early voting, it's early, so you can't say exactly what's going to happen. We're not going to know till Tuesday. But they're in a fight, and this is a competitive race. And a lot of people, when you see Oprah and other celebrities, and not just celebrities, my colleagues did a story, a lot of, you know, high profile Democrats who may be looking to run in 2020 for the presidency, they're also down there campaigning because they see this as an important race and as maybe Stacey Abrams going down a path or showing a way that you can be a Democrat and win in the South.
Some of the big names showing up in Georgia. We've got some of the big names in journalism right here with us. Mary Bruce, Aisha Rasko, Jack Beatty. Stick around, folks. We're dissecting this week's biggest news stories. You can join our conversation. Remember the swamp? Trump promised his administration would drain it. Has he? Or is the swamp washing over him? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're talking about a big week in the news. You can join the conversation. What other stories are on your mind, on your radar this week? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with NPR White House reporter Aisha Rasko, ABC congressional correspondent Mary Bruce, and our own On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. I want to quickly touch on a couple of quick items that were in the news outside of Washington. Google employees across the globe engaged in mass walkout and mass protests against their own company in the wake of revelations about a senior executive who left the company with a big severance pay after having been accused of sexual harassment. Yesterday, Google employee Dema Rodriguez addressed the rally employees that walked out of the tech giant's New York offices. She told protesters the company isn't the intellectual haven it promises to be.
It is not that place for women. It is not that place for people who are differently abled. It is not that place for people of color. And to be honest with you, when it is not that place for those groups, that means that the company is failing everyone.
So don't be evil is the company's mantra and employees questioning whether it's at least not being good. Jack Beatty, I wanted to call on your vast reservoirs of knowledge when it comes to all things Boston. We learned this week of the news that Whitey Bulger, an infamous crime boss, an FBI informant, was killed by inmates at a federal institution in West Virginia. Remind us about Whitey Bulger and what his death means to you.
Well, he was a famous gangster in Boston and murderer, and his career went really from the 50s right up into the 90s when he disappeared, and he disappeared because he got a tip-off from his friend in the FBI that he was about to be arrested. And that was part of the scandal of Whitey Bulger, that he had this fellow he grew up with was in the FBI, and they had a mutually beneficial relationship that involved cash even to this FBI man. And, you know, for the longest time in Boston, he was a kind of mythic figure. People would joke, oh, Whitey took it. Where's Whitey? You know, because he was missing for 16 years, hiding in California. And they joked about it. But somewhere in there, I think in the 90s, the Boston Globe had a front page. And it had the faces, I believe, of 19 people on it. Those were people he was plausibly charged with murdering. Several of them, not even with a gun, that was his usual method, but with his bare hands. And that, I think, really suddenly took the took the nimbus away from Whitey. He wasn't, there's nothing glamorous about him. And meanwhile, it also came out that this, that he was supposedly protecting his neighborhood, South Boston, from drugs. Not a bit of it. He was deep in the drug business there, spoiling the lives of the people he claimed to be the sort of Robin Hood protector of. And then there was a further dimension to the scandal. His brother was the longtime Senate president in Massachusetts. And there were stories, there were charges that the Senate president's law practice prospered because Whitey put the arm on potential, on realtors and other things, over buildings that the law firm was involved in. All of that was part of the background charge and scandal surrounding this loathsome character.
Accountability taking years take place in and around Boston on all kinds of levels. On the other hand, a lot of names on the ballot. So let's return to the question of these midterm elections right now. Mary Bruce, what are the stakes for these elections?
They're tremendous. They're huge. I mean, you could argue that these will be the most consequential midterm elections that we've seen in recent history. And I think it's midterms are always a referendum on the president. But this is a president that unlike any that we've really seen before. And he's well aware. In fact, he's said openly that he is on the ballot. This will very much be a chance to take the temperature of the nation and what this country thinks of this administration, thinks of the job that it's doing. And remember what happens, if the balance of power changes. If the House does go to Democrats, which does seem likely, things are going to instantly change here around Washington. You are going to see a huge amount of investigations. They are going to be looking into everything about this president, ranging from, calling for his tax returns to looking into possible collusion with Russia. And of course, there is that looming I word, impeachment, which hangs over all of this as well. So the stakes, the consequences are tremendous.
Mm-hmm. The National Security Advisor John Bolton was recently speaking to the Alexander Hamilton Society, and he said that excessive ethics checks discourage outsiders from joining the government.
The excessive nature of the so-called ethics checks, the kinds of investigations that people have to go through. If you were designing a system to discourage people from coming into the government, you would do it exactly this way. And that risks building up a priestly class of people who only serve in the government.
This week we learned from the Washington Post, I believe, among others, that the Interior Secretary has had complaints about his behavior referred by his agency's Inspector General to the Justice Department for possible criminal prosecution. That is, some of his acts as a cabinet secretary. Aisha Rasko, of course, the president promised that he would drain the swamp, that he would eliminate a corrupt culture in Washington that he said permeated the nation's capital. How well has he done? What's the state of ethics that surrounds his cabinet and his government at this time?
There have been a number of ethics investigations into his cabinet. Most notably, obviously, was the former EPA administrator, Scott Pruitt, who ended up having to leave his position. But only after after scandal came out about, the way he was using government money and et cetera, and the way he was interacting with his staff. And now here you have another cabinet secretary, the Interior Secretary, who's facing scrutiny and having these investigations by the agency's Inspector General. And so there are reports that the White House is concerned about this. Obviously, in the past, some of these people, especially Pruitt, was able to hang on for a long time. So I don't know whether Zinke is really going to face a lot of consequences for this. It may depend on how things go with the election and how the White House is feeling afterwards. But right now, when you look at has President Trump been able to drain the swamp, there have been a lot of ethical questions and concerns. And as Mary was saying, if the Democrats are able to take over the House, all of this stuff is going to be looked into very closely, and you're going to see thing you're going to see investigation after investigation of all of these cabinet secretaries and the White House.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to take a call now from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Nate, what's driving your vote this coming election?
Hi. Well, I'm actually being driven by the very important, I think, idea of having supposedly elected officials being accountable to voters rather than their party. And in this, we have to get rid of Scott Walker here in Wisconsin because of the gerrymandering going on. But there's also people who are involved in putting their party ahead of honest elections across the country. You've got attorney generals in Nevada, Georgia, Ohio, Missouri, who all put basically their party above honest elections, which means being above being accountable to voters.
Nate, can you tell me what you mean by that when you say they're putting their party above honest elections?
Well, what I mean is there was a conscious effort to gerrymander across the U.S. In different state governments at important levels that would then redraw maps to basically make people immune from future elections if they manage to get themselves elected. And this is at the state legislature level, but that also impacts the House. And the document I was referring to was of the Gill versus Whitford case, specifically brief 16-1161, where these people basically made the argument that partisanship should take precedence over people having honest elections for who represents their state, which is really turning the idea of state government being closer to the people and more representative totally upside down.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Nate. Jack Beatty, as you follow the coverage and developments in some of these races this fall, how much is the nature of voting, the nature of elections themselves playing out?
Well, you mentioned Georgia and the efforts there to purge the voting rolls of people who hadn't, I think, voted in 2 or 3 years. I think there are nearly 1 million people were purged. And then there were these other matters of, you know, were the signatures all correct and so on. And in Dakota, North Dakota, there was something even about the ink used. If the ink wasn't the right color, you couldn't be Indian people on Native American reservations weren't being counted. There's an effort to keep people there. They don't have street addresses in these vast reservations. Therefore, they can't vote in state elections because the Republican legislature saw to that. The Republican Party is a minority party. Let's just insist on that. The facts are so. And they can only hold power by manipulating the rules legally, to prevent people voting. And being sustained in this by a largely Republican appointed, at least a Republican majority on the Supreme Court, that's an attack really on democracy, on majoritarianism. And, you know, it's David Frum, who was a George Bush speechwriter, has said, if conservatives conclude that they can't get what they want through democracy, they won't give up conservatism. They will give up on democracy. We're seeing it lived out.
Jack, can I just push back for a moment? I mean, aren't there bookstores that are essentially graveyards for books that declare the end of the Republican Party or the end of the Democratic Party's ability to hold on sizable and working majorities of the voting public? Aren't there sort of pendular shifts, and don't parties sort of ultimately expand and contract to figure out ways to appeal to enough people to hold on to power?
They do, and political arithmetic usually is that. It's addition. With Mr. Trump, it's subtraction. He's contracting the Republican electorate right down to its sort of white working class core, rural. And, the demographic trends are clear. Younger voters overwhelmed by 2-1 in a recent poll, Democratic. Minority voters, Hispanic voters, Democrat. This is the future. This is the demographic future. The Republicans see that coming. And they could have adapted. George W. Bush wanted them to with immigration reform, but the conservatives in his own party couldn't stomach it.
We have a call now from Jefferson, Maine. Martha, you're on the air. What are you thinking about this election season?
Hi. Well, I wanted to make a couple of quick points. One was, I think that the reason that people are going to vote in unusual numbers is because they have been protesting since the day after the election. But protests are one thing. Vote is your constitutional right to exercise your opinion and to say what you want to change. And the swamp hasn't been drained. I mean, if we have a president who's getting close to 5,000 misstatements and lies, and he clearly doesn't even never read the Constitution, if he doesn't understand that the 14th Amendment makes everybody who's born here a citizen, and that was upheld by the Supreme Court in 1898 for the children of slaves who had come here illegally. And the fact of the matter is that this is probably one of the most important elections we've had in decades. I mean, I think 2016 was important, but it didn't go the way a lot of people wanted, the majority of Americans. So now we have a chance to change things and try to set things right. And the only way it's going to do it is if people get out to vote. And
okay, Martha, thank you so much for that. You're hearing fired up Democratic voters. We understand on the Republican side there's some passion as well. A little news from Washington. The Secretary of State has announced that upcoming sanctions on Iranian oil sales are intended to place maximum pressure on the Iranian government to change its behavior in the Mideast. Trump administration, of course, withdrew the United States from the 2015 nuclear deal. It has been continuing with other great powers, but these sanctions are intended to perhaps bust that out. With the, call it, minute and a half we have left, Mary Bruce, tell us a little bit, you know, in thinking about these, this election and the stakes that Martha and other voters and other analysts have placed on it, what races are you looking to determine whether or not there will be a shift in the balance of power in Washington?
Oh, there's so many interesting races. It's one
Pick
of the tough. It's one of the tough things about this election. I think the only thing that's certain at this point out is the amount of uncertainty right now. What fascinates me are a couple things. One, what's going to happen in those deep red states where you currently have Democrat incumbents, those moderate Democrats who have embraced some of President Trump's policies, voted with Republicans on some issues. What happens to them now? I'm talking about, you know, Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota, Claire McCaskill in Missouri. I've spent a lot of time on the ground in both of those states. It will be interesting to see how those voters have shifted over the last 2 years, if at all. And then you have so many fascinating firsts in this election, which are really amazing. Not only do you have this record number of women who are running, more than a quarter of all candidates are women, more than 80 of them women of color. You also have just a whole slew of firsts, you know, a larger number of LGBTQ women candidates running, more veterans running. You could have the first African-American female governor down in Georgia, as we were talking about.
Sure.
And it's just a remarkable sign of where the country is right now, the direction in which we are moving. So it will be amazing to see, you know, history will be made one way or another. Let's put it that way.
You've been hearing the voice of Mary Bruce. She's a congressional correspondent for ABC News. Mary, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We've also had Ayesha Rascoe. She's NPR's White House reporter. Thanks, Ayesha.
Thank you.
And On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Jack, have a great weekend.
Thank you.
A note to listeners, be sure to tune into our special broadcast of On Point from Madison, Wisconsin next Friday. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hartzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Allison Poley, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, and Miriam Wasser, with help from Madeline D'Angelo, Justine Daum, and Lexi Puri. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Coming up Monday, the final push for the midterms. We'll check in around the country. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.